because it's very rocky and uneven. And we could see the chief is actually holding them up as they're taking them to the helicopter. You know, when we put our mind together, our minds, we can do things. We don't have to be violent. In those ones, those early activism days, you know, we weren't swearing at the policemen or the fisheries officers or screaming at them. We were standing there together with our head up, looking them in the eye. I was so proud of the people at that time for what they were doing. And then all of a sudden, you know, along comes 1990 and the Oka crisis. And one of my friends, who was a chief of his community, because we're following it on the news. And I was working for the tribal council at that time, and so I'd meet with them, and he phoned me and he says, "Jerry," he says, "I can't take it anymore. I'm going to blockade the road that runs through my community, the highway, in support of those people in Oka." He says, "I was watching TV and they were burning effigies of indigenous people. The Canadians were protesting in Montreal and Oka, and they were burning effigies of indigenous people." It shocked him and disturbed him. He says, "I can't take it anymore." So I said, "Okay, we'll come and support you." By the time we got there, the RCMP had arrested him. He was all by himself in the road. They came and arrested him. So we went to liberate him at the jail, me and another chief. And we got him. We got him out. I don't to this day understand how it happened, but it happened. So we went to the next community. This time in force, we gathered people and we blockaded the highway. And we had pamphlets to hand out to the people, informing them what we were doing. We could see that the townspeople and business people were getting upset. And we talk amongst ourselves and we say, we're not really against them. You know, it's the government that we need their attention. So we decided to move the blockade off the highway and put it onto the railroad, which was BC, the provincial government's railroad, BC Rail. So we went to my community and set up a blockade there and stopped the trains. After our second day, the helicopter landed in the field by where we were, and we're surprised it was the Premier of British Columbia. Someone came to me, and we were having a ceremony, and they said, "Hey, the Premier's here. He wants to meet with you guys, the chiefs, the leadership." So we sent word, you know, set up a circle on the tracks and tell them we'll be there after our ceremony's done. So we finish the ceremony, then we go up and sit in a circle on the tracks with the Premier. He told us, he says, "Hey, boys," he called us boys. He says, "Every day you guys are sitting here, we're losing $1 million a day. So I come here to see if you guys will stop." We wanted them to acknowledge our declaration that our chiefs had made in 1910. that we hadn't given up our land, our territory. So he signed it. He says, you guys stop the blockade now? And we said, no, we want to meet with your cabinet to discuss our land claims issues. So he said, okay. And I said, we don't hear from you. And we gave him a couple of days and we didn't hear from him. We said, we'll set up the blockade again. And we did. We set up the blockade again. Again, we were organized and we instructed the people, no one to talk to the media. Only specific people were going to talk to the media. And we're not going to have weapons, alcohol, or drugs. I remember the feelings, the tension as the RCMP started to arrive. One of our members, there was one road that come to our community, public road. There was another one, but it's a BC Hydro right-of-way road, very narrow. They call it the Goat Trail. So you could say there's one way in by road and by rail. So the RCMP had driven, one of our members seen them, and they stopped this vehicle and they let out snipers and deployed themselves at the edge of our reserve from where we were. We couldn't see them, but we knew they were there. I remember the first arrest. We would go on shifts onto the track. If one group got arrested, the next group would go on. So our first group, this large helicopter came in, and they arrested that first group. I can still see them. They were handcuffed behind their back with these plastic cuffs. And they had them kneel in the field waiting for the helicopter to land. And they took them. Then later on that afternoon, we went to our community hall for a feast, for dinner. And there had been RCMP that ended up on foot. And they had to cross through our reserve to get out of there. And so their vehicles had come and they were on one side and they were waiting. And someone come up to us and said, hey, there's these RCMP coming up the road. So we went out to look, and sure enough, we could see all this, like, a bunch of RCMP officers with German Shepherds, and they were marching towards us. So we all went out onto the road and started walking towards them. And as I was in the front line, as we got close, all of a sudden I could see their commander saying, go, 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 go. And they all started trotting towards us with their batons out. And the police dogs. And I was right in front, and this police dog lunged at me and I stuck out my hand drum. And he clamped onto the edge of my hand drum. So I'm yanking it to get it out of his mouth. And I get it out, and another RCMP officer had come up beside us, you know, and the dog was on the leash. And I yanked a drum out of his mouth. The dog seen that RCMP officer beside him, seen his leg, and he did, clamped onto his leg, and he was mauling that policeman's leg. And the officer was screaming, "Get him off me, get him off me." The dogs were frenzied. So they kept rushing through our line, and they're grabbing people, arresting them, till they got and they loaded them under vehicles and left. We started to put out a call for support after that. The next day, the RCMP, I guess the commander, early in the morning I was down there with the chiefs and we're having coffee, and he walks in. He had a riding crop under his arm. I remember he had blue eyes, and he's looking around. He says, "Beautiful day." And he left. Later on, I don't know how long after, maybe an hour or two, they came in on force. Helicopters and buses. The buses were like a mobile jail cell. They had, the interior was lined with like fencing material. So they were packing us off the tracks. And there is, I don't know, there's a whole bunch of us. They separated me and two of the chiefs and put us in a jail cell. They come in, they're going to fingerprint us. One of the chiefs says, "We're not criminals. You're not going to fingerprint us. We're not criminals." So we refused to be fingerprinted. Then they brought in these documents and said, "If you guys sign these, we'll let you out right now. You sign this and you promise you're not going to do this anymore. And we'll let you go. You'll be free." But we refused to sign them. And one of the chiefs sent word out. He said he's going on a hunger strike. As soon as he said that, all of a sudden, the jail was surrounded by our people. And the RCMP let us go. Right after that, in Oka, they'd called the army, and the army came. And we had people up there. We sent people over to support them. So we thought we better go get them. So me and other members of our nation, two of the chiefs, we went over to get our people. That was a surreal experience, like a fantasy, like shouldn't be happening. We got there and we were going to go to where our people were, behind the barricades. They'd been barricaded in by the army. We were going in the night, I remember, and we're going through this forest. There's a helicopter flying above the forest with a spotlight. We would leave and we'd run to the next set of trees and hide till the helicopter was going in another direction. We'd run again. And while we're doing this, we'd see half tracks, army vehicles with machine guns and soldiers. And I remember watching and saying, "This is surreal, man. This is Canada. Can't be." But it was. And there was razor wire with soldiers standing behind with their rifles. I remember one of our young members, we marched up to the razor wire and we were singing. One of our members went right up to a soldier and said, "Are you going to shoot me?" Yeah, we stayed there until the negotiations fell through, and then it was over. There were people from all over the continent there to support, show support. From the United States, from all over the country. The potential for change at that time was huge because one of the negotiating issues was sovereignty. If that was signed, I think we'd be in a different situation today, but it didn't, so that's why I think we still need to unite, to put our minds and hearts and spirits together. So that's my path. After that, I started working with addictions again, prevention, education, healing. Started to work with residential school survivors, support them as they're going through civil court and criminal court. I still know that we do need to make noise. We need to let them know what's unacceptable. But we also must have a plan. We must have replacements to put in place. If we don't like the Indian Act, we must develop an act or a way for us to govern ourselves. Not just rise up in anger and rage. I see some of the things that are going on, and it's important that it brings light to the issue, but I say, what's swearing at a police officer, sticking your middle finger at him or her? How is that going to change anything? So I get disappointed with that, because I know that's not our way, that we're honorable people, dignified. That we shouldn't stoop to their low level, to speak the low language, the foul language, that's low language. You know, that's, they can't describe something without swearing about it. As my young neighbor here was asked me what I thought about what is going on in the United States with Black Lives Matter and stuff. So I told him I get saddened to see what's going on. I get inspired to see the courage of people, and I'm hopeful that there'll be change. And I said, I go up and down. I've been truthful with him. He's a 14-year-old Canadian kid, young man. I said, what do you think about it there, young feller? And he says, you know, it's totally despicable. And you know that after that conversation, I had more hope. If there are young people in Canada that recognize this, there's got to be hope here. Totally despicable. I know there's adults out there who will say, you know, it's totally effed up, man. You know, they swear about it. They got no ways of expressing how bad it is, other than to use the colonizer language. Low-life colonizers. That's how they talked. Anyway, so this is my appeal, that we unite and that we plan, we have a plan. That we become one mind, one heart, one spirit, about fairness for everyone. Saddens me to know about third missing indigenous woman in this country. Seems like nobody cares. Well, there are people that care, but not enough to go out and make noise in a big way. I guess that's part of the problem. Racism and chauvinism in this country and the world. But that's, I feel, is going to change. I'm going to finish off with the song I was singing, that song I heard by the fire. And these young activists that were spiritually governed were singing. And they're going, D.I.A., I'm not your engine. D.I.A., I'm not your engine. D.I.A., I'm not your engine. Hey-yo, hey, hey-yo, hey. Hey-yo, 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 hey-yo. Constitution, we don't need your Constitution. We don't need your Constitution. Hey, oh, hey, hey, oh, hey. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh. Hey yo, hey yo, hey yo, hey yo, hey yo, hey yo, hey. So that's my little talk on activism, and you know, it becomes a way of life. Being present, you know, standing up for what's right, making noise when we get stepped on. So they'll stop stepping on us, but doing it in unison, doing it with respect. Oh, and I'd hear the people from the Confederacy talking about 7 generations. And I heard this one of them saying, and we're talking about the full length of a life, like 80 years, 7 generations, that's over 500 years they're planning. They're doing it for the 7 generations. Then they start over after the 7th is reached, so it's going on forever. Not thinking in fiscal years or 5-year plan, but in 7 generations. That's what we must do for the planet and for the people. Not let the ill-doers or the evil-doers have their way, because they're so blatant about it. I often wonder, why don't we stop them? Why aren't they stopped? The ones that will destroy Mother Earth to make a profit. Why do we go along with this? And it's because, like my cousin told me, I'd be worrying about, you know, the ecosystem, about addictions, about violence, about suicide. And he said, Jerry, I want you to stop being a worrier. I want you to be a warrior. So I'd invite you to all think about that and make up your mind what you want to do. But that's my message. And hopefully you get something out of this. And in a way, I revisited my memory bank And the people that I was involved with, some of them aren't here now. And it was sort of sad looking back and knowing that, but also knowing that intense pride I had as Indigenous when we stood up together, when we linked arms, we put our resources together. And we planned, and we talked, and we implemented. So that's my take on activism, and thank you for listening, and until next time, see you later.